Spectrum Business keeps real businesses, like Rise Bakery, connected.
As a business owner, my Spectrum services help simplify my day. Everything we do is easier knowing that we've got a reliable connection. And it helps our business just run really smoothly. Even though our techniques are very ancient, we rely just as heavily on technology. Spectrum allows my business to go from surviving to thriving.
Keep your business running smoothly with Spectrum Internet, starting at $40 a month. Restrictions apply. Services not available in all areas.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
I'm Emma Greed, and I'm the host of the Aspire podcast, a show where I talk to the world's most brilliant minds about building the life of your dreams. Listen to and follow Aspire with Emma Greed, an Odyssey podcast, available now wherever you get your podcasts.
Play ball! It's 30 with Murdy with your host, Sweeney Murdy.
Welcome back, everyone. I'm back now with part two of my conversation with Mike Messina, part of the Hall of Fame class of 2019. If you missed part one, please go back and check it out. Thoughts from Messina on his path to the majors and his days with the Yankees that led him to Cooperstown. When Messina gets inducted this month, he will be one of the last starting pitchers elected from an era in which starting pitchers were a basic and essential part of a team's success. While that is still true to a certain degree, there's a lot less emphasis on the individual starting pitcher and his place in the game. In this half of our conversation, we discuss Messina's historical achievements in relation to where the game is today and where it's headed. And if you think the Stanford-educated Messina would be a fan of analytics, you will be surprised at his take on the new statistical revolution. Once again, this was recorded at a restaurant in Messina's hometown of Montoursville, PA in early June. You'll hear references to Craig Kimbrell and Dallas Keuchel, who were both still unsigned at the time. Here now is part two of my conversation with Mike Messina. I've had the opportunity recently to kind of take a little deeper dive into your 20-win season that closed it out in 2008. And I've come up with this idea. Follow me with this and tell me what you think.
Okay.
20 wins in your final year is essentially what got you into the Hall of Fame. Because I look at it this way.
The other 250 helped.
The other 250 certainly helped. But you've already told me about how what that last year before that felt like. You went 11-10.
Misery.
Five ERA. You weren't sure. Yeah, you weren't sure how much further you could go.
No.
Now, if you follow that up with, say, 8-12, you're sitting at 258. Perception is you've already been gone for 2 years, and now you finish at 270. Perception is, you know, if he wants to, he can keep going, but he decided he didn't want to. So that number looks a lot different to me based off solely off of that last season. Do you follow that logic?
I see what you're looking at.
Yeah.
Didn't you ask me in that last spring training that I had 250 wins? Is that enough to be considered?
Somebody came to my locker,
which I thought it was you, and
maybe
said, you've won 250 games coming into this year. Do you think that's enough to be in the conversation for the Hall of Fame? I said something to the effect that, well, I'm pretty sure my best pitching is behind me,
right,
not in front of me.
Right.
So I would hope that if my best stuff is worth the conversation at all, then yeah, I would hope that maybe 250 is worth the conversation. But if it's just worth the conversation and that's all the farther it goes, at least they talked about it. So do I think that the 20 win season probably, you know, could have been the extra little boost, kick, whatever you want to call it, that made people look again,
right,
look one more time.
Right.
But if I'd have gone 8-12, I mean, I was getting out of the game because I knew it was time to get out.
Right.
It was just not worth going through that effort anymore. But there are a lot of other guys, and there are a lot of guys in the Hall of Fame that their last 2 years or 3 years
a lot
were not high quality.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm certainly thankful for the 20 wins of last year. And probably got me over the last hurdle for this. But I'm certainly pleased that I was able to go out of the game having had a final season like that.
As you said, we don't know the next guy who's even going to get to 270, let alone 300. So when you hear people talk about, like, the win doesn't matter, the win is unimportant, the win is overrated as a statistic, I understand that it doesn't say a lot about that individual game, but I still feel like the accumulation of wins over a longer period of time probably tells you more about that pitcher, or tells you a great deal about that pitcher, than just trying to pick an individual win when a guy might happen to be in the game when they score three times in the seventh and picks up a W. Do you have a greater appreciation for the accumulation of wins now that you see where the game has gone?
I think people have slightly failed to remember that ultimately it's whether you win or lose. Mm-hmm. Like, the teams that go to the playoffs aren't based on team batting average or team ERA.
Right.
It's based on whether you win or you lose. So I think in some respects, you know, I don't have a lot of control over what happens offensively on the team. So in some respects, me winning or losing isn't a definition entirely of how I threw that day, individual day. But I think you're right in the fact that if you accumulate numbers of wins, it means that over time, you stayed in the game long enough, because a starter has to pitch a certain amount. Right. It's not like they came in the seventh, got two outs, and somehow won a game. Right. You have to pitch long enough and be good enough, successful enough, whatever, often enough that you accumulate 270 or 250 or 300. And that's not easy to do. And I don't know when the next guy's going to get to 270. I think there's a couple guys out there that have a chance to get there, but it's based on health and a lot of things. So, like I said, I don't. We'll see, I guess.
Do you know how many complete games you finished with?
50-some.
57. Okay. In 536 starts, including 23 shutouts. I looked up a couple of guys just as a comparison. CC Sabathia has more starts than you, to this point, 547. He's only thrown 38 complete games, so 19 fewer. And I'm pretty sure he's not adding any more to that total this year. Clayton Kershaw, 25 complete games, less than half of what you had. Justin Verlander, 24 complete games, less than half. Max Scherzer only has 10 complete games in 342. These are guys who are going to be on that stage in Cooperstown one day with you. What do you think about just the way the game has moved to the point where you're not asked to finish anything anymore, and nobody is trying to figure out how to get through your last 10 pitches with the game on the line? It's 5-6 innings and see what you can get. I know you don't watch the game as closely anymore, but when I read those numbers to you, and the best pitchers in the game aren't coming close to finishing the same number of games, how does that make you feel?
It's just the change of the game. I mean, I finished 57 games. The generation ahead of me was finishing 25 a year.
Yeah.
So it's just the evolution of the game. You know, you end up throwing less innings over time, and it's you know, I don't even know how I would have been looked at if I was coming into the game today, instead of in 1991, how am I looked at in 2019? Do I throw hard enough? Can I, you know, is my stuff good enough to even be put out there? Because everybody today throws 96 with really nasty, you know, and they get them through five innings and 80 pitches, and we're on to the six inning guy, the seven inning guy, the eight inning guy, and the closer.
Yeah.
I mean, in some games they start a guy, he pitches one inning, and they move to somebody else. So the game has changed, but there are still guys out there that they just, you're not going to finish as many games. It's just how it is. But you know, if you're only going to pitch five innings a game, you're going to miss out on opportunities.
Right.
And over time, maybe it's two opportunities this year, and maybe it's two next year, and you know, maybe it's two. And if it's two every year for 10 years, that's 20.
Mm-hmm.
Well, then I go from 270 to 250.
Right.
And if you do that for 18 years, then I'm from 270, you know, down in the 230s.
Yeah.
And then we're not even sitting here.
Do you think you would have pitched differently if you knew that all you had to do was go 5-6 innings and there are elite arms coming out of the pen, would it have changed how you went about
the game? I think that changes how – that changes a lot. It has to change your philosophy of pitching.
Mm-hmm.
It has to. I mean, you know, we just – I was the very end of an era where finishing the game was a big deal. Like, and the managers that I started with were from the era of complete games.
Right.
So, you know, Johnny Oates caught guys that it was a complete game. Joe Torre, you know, it was a complete game. That's just how the game was then. It changed. It evolved. It became something else. And you're right. There's going to be guys who come up and get elected to the Hall of Fame who won't win 250 games. And it's about awards and achievements. And longevity of a career isn't going to be the same,
right?
Because maybe careers won't be as long.
Right.
I mean, guys are making so much money now, they don't have to push it out there as far as other guys had to push it out there to keep having income.
Yeah.
So I guess we'll just see how it goes. But the way it's looking now, I think Verlander has a chance to win 270 games.
Yeah.
But you just have to see. You never know. Things can change really quickly. I hope he stays healthy, and I hope he has a chance. We'll see.
I remember the number 500 being very important to you, the innings markers. Every 500 innings, you'd roll a ball into the dugout because
right.
It meant something. You know, nowadays, I mean, you pitched at one point very early in your career. You were pitching over 240 innings a year, so every couple of years. You know, now it's going to take guys 3 or 4 years to get there. Why was that number? How did that start, and why was it so important every 500 innings to mark it for you?
I don't know how it started. I think it was just something that, for me personally, it was like, hey, I stayed in this league long enough to pitch 500 innings.
Yeah.
And now I pitched 1,000 innings already in the major leagues. It's pretty, you know, and you just kind of just look at it like it's just a small milestone, but it's something that's kind of cool that I get to do. I've done this long enough now to get to so many innings. And,
mm-hmm.
And it also meant that I was out there doing my job like I was supposed to do my job. So I'm a starter. I'm going 6 or 7 innings. You know, I'm out there long enough to accumulate stuff like this.
Right.
And it was reassuring that I knew what I was doing and that it wasn't just luck. You know, you don't throw 3,000 innings on luck. So
yeah.
Now, I don't have the innings that some guys did. There are guys who pitched a lot more years and in eras that you were throwing 300 innings a year.
Yeah.
I didn't pitch in that era, but it's still satisfying to look back and say, you know, I started over 500 games and ended up with 3,500 innings. You know, it was almost 7 innings a game for my career.
Yeah.
And I won more than half my starts. And there's not a lot of people that get to say that as a starting pitcher. You don't get to say over almost 18 seasons.
The way it's going now, first of all, like scouting reports. Did you like detailed scouting reports? Did you like going over those? I mean, that was all the information you had back then. You didn't like those? You didn't like diving into those too much?
No, I didn't dive at all.
Okay.
So
I think I know where this is going to go, but I'm going to ask you. The analytic revolution now, all the data that's out there and being provided. The trick, I know, as people say it, is knowing who can handle how much information and not overloading somebody who is just going to get paralyzed by it. But would you have, you didn't like those, would you have liked to know the sort of data that the analytic-driven people today are giving the athletes, giving the pitchers and the hitters, and trying to make them better? Would you have liked that kind of information?
It's hard to say. Simply because I didn't grow up with that information available to me. I had to learn it a different way. So I never looked at that stuff. I never watched too much film. I just wanted to know basically who was going good and who wasn't going good
mm-hmm.
in their lineup. You know, okay. So if a guy is, you know, if a guy is 6 for his last 10, I'd like to know that he was 6 for his last 10. And who did he get those hits off of? Was it, you know, lefties, and or was it somebody that's like me?
Right.
And so so those were kind of the factors I looked at, and how did I feel, and what did he do against me last time? And because you know how the schedule works. Sometimes you face the same team twice inside of 10 days.
Yeah.
And so you have to remember what worked the last time.
Yeah.
And remember the fact that, yeah, this is only, there's only been one other start between when I faced him last time or this time, or maybe none. Maybe I had him the last game at their place, we played somebody else for a series, and now I got him here at our place, and this is two starts in a row for me. But they played four other games.
Yeah.
So they've had this guy come in the plate has 12 at-bats against other pitchers, not me, since the last time I saw him. So you have to take all that into account. But I didn't worry about, you know, his exit velocity or spin rates or whatever other stuff.
Sure.
Can I get the breaking ball over the plate and get this guy off balance enough to get him to hit a ground ball to shortstop? That's basically...
I think a lot of what they try to do now is they tell a guy, listen, the spin rate on your curveball is really good. You should be throwing it more than you do. You're not throwing it enough. You're not having enough as much success as you could. The Astros have been really good at that. Is that something that you would have been receptive to? You had a lot of pitching coaches, I know, over the years. But is that type of analysis something that you would have been open to?
I mean, I have no problem listening to analysis. Yeah. If they're going to sit there and tell me that, you know, they're only hitting 146 off your breaking ball, and I'm like, okay, what were the counts? You know, they're like, well, we don't have that.
Yeah.
Well, okay, a breaking ball in a 1-2 count versus a 2-2 count is a different animal. So you have to. There's a lot of things that are involved in your analysis, and. There's a lot. If you're going to give me analysis stuff, then it kind of has to be spelled out the way I think about it. Like when I'm on the mound, if I'm going to get the guy out with a breaking ball, I got him out with a breaking ball. This was the count last time.
Thanks for lunch.
Or I didn't get him out with it, or I got myself in a bad situation because I threw this pitch in this count. So I don't want to get myself in that situation again. So there's stuff that runs through the equation that's in my head that maybe they're not going to provide for me. So I didn't really, my equation, and that's the one thing that people just don't understand. Like I throw a pitch, and I've got a ball coming back from the catcher, and I'm going to go back up on the mound and throw the next pitch in about 15 or 20 seconds total time.
Yeah.
Maybe a little more. I have to answer 15 questions in those 15 seconds in my own head.
Right. And the catcher has to be thinking with you.
I told Posada this too a lot, because when I first went over there and I shook him, he would sometimes get a little offended by it. I'm like, listen, you're making a suggestion. Don't get offended.
Mm-hmm.
You're suggesting what you think, and I'm either agreeing or I'm going to go with what I think. And since my name's next to the L or the W, I'm going to go with what I think, okay?
Yeah.
Okay. And that's just how it was. So he doesn't really have to think with me.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it works out better.
Sure.
There's less shaking and less... Like it keeps the game moving a little better, but he's looking at my stuff from his perspective, and I'm looking at my stuff from my perspective.
Mm-hmm.
He may not see if I'm like right on target or the ball's coming out of my hand that it feels the way I want it to feel or whatever. He doesn't know that stuff, so he's making a suggestion, and I'm making my evaluation of the situation at that moment based on a lot of stuff. Who's up? Where are the base runners? How many outs are there? Where are we in the game? What's he seen before? What was the sequence? Boom, boom. You know, there's seven things right there I just said in like 10 seconds.
Mm-hmm.
And that's all the stuff that I'm evaluating really quickly. There's a lot going on in the catcher's head too. I'm not expecting him to do the same evaluations every time. He may not think like I think. And so, but that's what, you can give me a lot of info, but I'm still going to go back on my experience and my firsthand knowledge of facing the guy in the batter's box, because spray charts and all the numbers you have aren't against me.
Yeah.
Some of them, maybe a very small percentage of are against me, but not all of them are.
When I watch a guy during the course of a season get get roughed up in a bad start, and they happen a few times a year. And really good pitchers, it still happens to them.
Absolutely.
If I watch CC Sabathia or Masahiro Tanaka get knocked around, I always come back in my head to what I kind of refer to as your rule of 30. Okay, you have 30 starts in a year. 5 times a year, you're going to have great. Is it more than that?
32.
Okay, 32.
Use
32. Okay,
quarter,
so I'll one up.
Quarter and a half.
Gotcha. So I'm well. I basically said to 8, 8, and 16.
Eight great, and 16 in the middle.
I undershot because I was going to say like 5 or 6 great, 5 or 6 terrible, and everything else in between.
I would say once a month plus one here or there. That's
okay.
About 8.
Okay.
So once a month you feel really good.
Mm-hmm.
Once a month plus a little, you feel like you have no idea what you're even doing.
Mm-hmm.
How did I get on this team?
Yeah.
And the other 16 are somewhere in between.
Those in between. That's what separates. That's what makes the great pitchers better. That's what makes them great. With all due respect to my theory about the 20 wins, that's what gets you to the Hall of Fame. Those games in between where you have to figure it out.
That's half a season.
Yeah.
Half a season of not your best and not your worst. So, and the problem is you're analyzing the best, and the best is like close your eyes, throw it real hard, it goes right where you're thinking about. Or your breaking ball is... You're trying to throw it for a strike. It's low. It's right there. Bang. You're trying to throw it for a strikeout pitch. It's just below the zone. You know, everything's working just how you would write it up. And you get one of those 1 out of 5 or 1 out of 6 times out there, whatever it is. But, you know, the ones in between, maybe you don't have a good breaking ball that day. Maybe the ball just doesn't have any life coming out of your hand, or you don't feel like it does. Your location isn't how you would love it to be. And you got to figure it out. You just have to figure it out. That's really why I never had a scouting report game plan thing, because I didn't know what it was going to be like when I left the bullpen.
Right.
So, and Flaherty talks about this all the time. Flaherty called me a couple times, and the first time he did, he asked me, "Okay, Michael, let's get together and figure this out." I go, "Figure what out?" He said, "We got to have a game plan." I said, "No, we don't have a game plan until we come out of the bullpen and figure out what we got."
Yeah.
Well, I'm not real comfortable doing that. We'll be okay. But that's what you do. And the bullpen itself isn't necessarily a good barometer of how the game's going to be. You're throwing a catcher with no batter,
right,
in an enclosed two walls going down the side situation, yeah, versus out in the game.
Yeah.
It's not the same atmosphere at all. So maybe what didn't work here is going to work out there. What did work here won't work. Let's go face some hitters and see what we got.
Yeah.
And that's... And that's how I kind of formulated my day.
Out of 100 pitches, how many would you end up throwing at top velocity? Because it seems like nowadays it's a very high percentage of them. Yeah.
Probably at max effort, out of 100 was probably, I would say probably 30% maybe.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that would seem right. If you face 30 hitters, you know, and that's one a hitter. So you're probably going to absolute max effort on the out pitch, and that's probably how I would just look at it as a guess. Maybe
you watch a lot more high school games now than you do professional,
sure,
major league games. What are you seeing? Are you seeing them try to do that, just throw everything as hard as they can? Are you seeing, and I understand we're not talking about guys who are going to be professionals, but they're watching professionals and they're trying to maybe copy some of the things that they see. So what do you see about the game and the guys who might someday become, you know, the future pros? What do you see that they're trying to do that you like or don't like?
Well, I think my job is coaching high school sports and baseball in particular is to try to convince them that 100% every pitch isn't really the best approach.
Mm-hmm.
And when you hit, because all these kids hit too, it's not,
sure,
like the American League where they don't hit. So I said, when you hit and the guy throws you 4 fastballs as hard as he can, by probably the third one, you got a pretty good beat on it.
Mm-hmm.
But if he throws you a fastball, a curve, a change, something up at your eyes, and then something else down low, and maybe the breaking balls aren't at the same speed, you know, it's tougher to hit. You're a hitter. You stand there. You know it. The ball's not going straight over and over and over again. The curveball is not as hard as you physically can throw it every single time. You're going to be more successful if it's at like 90%, if you work at 90%. And then you can go off 90% and you can add to 90%. But let's work at a space where we can be more consistent and successful with what we're trying to do. Because you can throw the best pitch in the world and the guy can flick his bat at it and still get a hit.
Right.
And you can throw one right down the middle where it should go over the fence and he pops it straight up, or he misses it, or he takes it.
Right.
So let's just control what we can control. And this is the best way to do that. And 100% effort on every throw is not the best way to do it. And once you convince them of that, they usually will play along that way. And that's all I'm trying to do, is I'm showing them that the little league way, where if you're the hardest thrower in the league and you just throw hard all the time and you still strike them out, it doesn't work that way anymore.
Yeah.
Let's be better. Let's make ourselves better than just how hard can I throw it.
You played through a time period which is easy to say the worst in as far as the relationship between players and management. You had a work stoppage longer than any other. Baseball got through that. And even though there are people who still think there's something coming soon, the economics of the game has changed a bit. And, you know, you played in a time where there was a lot of money being made and it was being handed out to players over 30 very easily. You were a recipient of that. It's not the same anymore. I'm wondering just what you think about how the game has changed economically and where you might think it's going, just based off the talent level and what teams are signaling now is that once you get to a certain point, we know you're not going to be as profitable for us as you were in your 20s, so we're not going to be as willing to give you that kind of money. It's taken a lot of the older players, the leadership qualities that those players bring. It's taken a lot of that out of the game. What do you think about the state of that right now?
That was a really long question.
It was. I specialize in those.
I think this is still something that you're just going to have to let it play out and see where we are, because I mean, I don't know how many 40-year-olds are playing.
Yeah.
It doesn't seem like very many.
No.
I mean, just to simply look at something like, okay, how many pitchers, active pitchers, have 150 or 200 wins? Just pick a number.
Yeah.
And it's not a very big number.
Right.
And I was fortunate. You know, I was playing in an era where there were Clemens, Maddox, Glavin, Randy Johnson. There are 300-game winners still competing.
Right.
There's barely a 250-game winner competing.
Right.
And it's because they aren't playing as long. And maybe it's because of the type of player everybody's looking for. They're looking for the guy that throws 98 with a nasty slider or splitter or whatever it is. And you can't throw 98 for your whole life. So if you don't learn to pitch, you won't be around a long time. Maybe they're afraid that you've just historically you're going to break eventually.
Yeah.
And that's what they were worried. I know they were worried about that with me. I'd never had arm surgery.
Right.
When I went to New York and they gave me a 6-year contract, and I know people said, you're crazy.
Right.
He's due to break down.
Yeah.
And somehow, luckily, I didn't. And I turned out to be worth what I was paid.
Yeah.
And even for the 2 other years after the first year. So for 8 years, I basically I was worth what I got paid. So I just don't think ownership now is willing, based on how the game is, to throw a lot of money out to older players when they can just throw less money out to younger players.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of the nature of the game. And I hope it doesn't stay that way. I know, and I don't even know if it's, as we're sitting here, there's like high-level starters and closers, at least one of each that I know of, who aren't on a team.
Right.
And they're a little older.
Yeah.
They're not necessarily like 35.
Right.
But they're a little older, but they have an expectation of what they want to sign for, and they won't take less, and people won't play it, organizations won't offer it.
Right.
Well, you know, I kind of... People ask me about that, like you're saying, that these guys aren't signed yet. And like, listen, I'm going to be honest, and I'm nothing against any of the players, because I think players should get what they deserve. But, you know, I'm an old car guy, and I can think an old car is worth something.
Yeah.
And if somebody else isn't willing to give it to me, then the car's not worth what I think it's worth. So the car stays mine because I that guy wants it, but he's not willing to pay for it. So I, you know, you should get what you are worth. But on the other side of it, if they're not willing to pay what you are worth, then you're not going to get it. So it's business. It's unfortunate, but it's business. And but there's a lot of guys out there making a lot of money. There's there's big numbers out there that are obviously in the 10 years since I played a lot bigger than 10 years ago. So the money's out there. It's just not that the older player just doesn't have an opportunity like they did before, I guess is the best way to put it.
You once told me that Major League Baseball to you might as well just been another TV show that you watched, because it was something from where you live, it was another world away, and getting there just seemed like a dream kind of far out there. Does it seem now you're right back where you started? So does it seem like it happened? Does it seem like it happened to somebody else? Does it seem like it was a different lifetime?
It doesn't seem like it happened to somebody else, but it does seem like a different, like it was, I don't know, like I lived for a while, and then I became somebody else for a little while, and then came back to the first guy. I don't know. It's just to sit here now and watch games on television, and to still see a couple guys that I played with. There aren't many left. There's a couple out there, or against. It's just so strange that this is how it started. Watching the Yankees on television, and it being like reality TV, and I've even said this to like the people from the Hall of Fame. It was like they're actors. I had no relationship with anything professionally, like to know what a professional baseball player or a professional athlete was even like. So they could have, who knows, they're on TV. What could have been any, I didn't know. And I'm a little kid watching on television, and I never get to see a pro game until I was like 10 years old. And when I did, it was from way up in the mezzanine at Yankee Stadium. And so it was just a different world. And I went from this world to that world and back to this world. And that's kind of how I lived it. And that's why I still say I don't know how I did it. I don't know how I ended up being as successful as I was and how I got to the Hall of Fame. I don't know how I did it. I can't write a book and tell you anything about how it happened. I just kept playing. And they kept telling me to keep playing, and I kept going. And then I got to say when I stopped. And most players don't get to say that. And so I'm really thankful that I had the opportunity to at least do that at the end.
I always found it kind of funny that you could go from one world to the other really quickly, because I remember at least a couple of times where you guys got eliminated at home in a playoff series. You just got in the car and drove home a couple hours, and you were done the next that morning.
That was it.
By 3 in the morning, it was over.
Yeah, that was the finality of seasons sometimes is really tough. Like that was, we just lost our high school state playoff game, and you know, you get on the bus and you go into the game and you don't realize what could happen to you if you lose. I mean, this is the last sports season for like the graduating seniors. This is it.
Yeah.
And they don't realize it either until, wait a minute, it's over. I'm not a high school athlete anymore. And you know, the same thing happens every season with, you know, you go to a playoff game, if you're a playoff team, you go to that last playoff game and like, man, if we win this, we're going to, you know, you want to win, you're focusing on winning. And if you don't, like, wait a minute, now we got to pack up because it's over.
Right.
And then you switch gears and turn it and go to that other world for however long that lasts. And for the guys that live, you know, near where they play, it's not a lot of change.
Right.
It's the same world. They just don't go to the stadium. For us who go to a different place, you know, you just drive across the bridge from one island to the other island, and now we're going to stay here for a while. And that's kind of how I felt about it. And but it like I said, that last day when it was over, it wasn't like the end of high school or the end of college.
Yeah. 'Cause
I knew I had made a decision already, and I knew what was next. I wasn't caught by surprise by what was next. So I'm really lucky that I got to do that. That was one of my luckier, fortunate things that happened to me in baseball.
Are there any of the almosts that still bother you?
10 years or more later? I hope not. I hope not. I don't. I mean, we lose the World Series with the best closer on the mound.
Yeah.
I lose a perfect game with two strikes. And, but, I mean, was I? The other guys are pros. Was I really supposed to throw a perfect game? You know, they're pretty good hitters. Yeah. And I don't have any regrets about anything. And the almost thing is a great story. It's great.
Yeah.
Part of the career.
Mm-hmm.
That all these almost things. I never won a World Series. I never won a Cy Young. I've been runner up for both. I barely ever led the league in any categories. You know, I didn't throw 98 miles an hour. It wasn't, you know, and yet I'm in the Hall of Fame.
Yeah.
So I think the almost stuff is just like how it was supposed to be. Everything happened. I still look, everything happened the way it was supposed to happen.
Mm-hmm.
And if it had happened any other way, then we wouldn't be talking about it. I mean, if I ever had to have arm surgery,
right,
we wouldn't be talking about it.
Right.
And if I won 11 games a year, 17 years in a row. If one year in the middle there, I miss half the season and only win 5 or 6,
yeah,
does it make a big difference? Maybe.
Right. Maybe it affects what happens after that.
It could. Mm-hmm. It makes a difference. Like maybe I'm not on the same team. Maybe mm-hmm. I'm. So it's just everything happened the way it was supposed to happen.
So knowing like who you are and where you're from and kind of what you do, I know that being elected to the Hall of Fame probably isn't going to send you to more card shows. I'm going to check no. You're not going out and about, right?
Yeah.
A TV job.
No.
I'm going to check no. Front office job. No. Manager. No. Pitching coach. No. So you've got a couple more years left with your younger son in high school where you want to keep coaching him. But I phrased it this way to Mariano Rivera. I said, getting into the Hall of Fame essentially closes the book on that part of your life, the baseball part of your life, and now it's the next part of your life.
Mm-hmm.
What do you want the next part of your life to be?
I think the next part of my life is already what I'm doing. Everybody who has children reaches the point where the children all grow up and go do their own thing. Everybody deals with that who has kids. And realistically, most of us who got the opportunity to play in the major leagues, when the career stops, that chapter stops. That part of your life stops. For me, 11 years later, I get to add a part of the...
Yeah.
Add another section of the movie that they cut out the first time, so they re-release it,
right.
You know,
yeah, uh-huh.
With an extra...
It's the paperback edition of the hardcover book.
With an extra 15 seconds of previously deleted material.
Uh-huh.
So it just... It I don't know. It's an opportunity to talk about my career again for a little bit, about how well it went and how fortunate I was, but the next chapter for me isn't real. For Mo's, Mo's only been out for 5 years. You know, he's in the first time, and Derek's going to get in the first time he's eligible.
Yeah.
And I've already been doing what's next. And
so you going to keep coaching when your son's graduated?
See, I don't know. I don't. I might.
Yeah.
I mean, but I might not. And you know, who knows? You know, your kids, as my kids get older, you know, you hopefully you have grandchildren or something, and then I think life kind of leads you to the next chapter.
Mm-hmm.
You're not gonna, mm-hmm. you can't like go out and say what it's going to be because you don't really know. And I think because it, you know, most of life for me is here, it's always been here, and I don't think it's going to be a big change. You're right. I'm not gonna take any coaching jobs. I'm not going to work for television. I'm not. I don't even want to coach high school gym class, you know, or teach high school gym class. Mm. I'm just content with what I'm doing. I love being retired. It just gives you opportunities to do things that you really want to do, and for the guys who have to don't get to retire until they're 65 or 70 years old.
Yeah, that's me. Mm-hmm.
You know, I get an opportunity to do things when I'm still able to do them, and that's one of the most fortunate things about what I was able to do and the job I had. That it doesn't last very long, but I got lucky enough that I can now enjoy retirement for a lot longer than most people get to enjoy retirement.
Other than getting it over with, what's the one thing you're most looking forward to about Hall of Fame weekend, the speech, and just being a Hall of Famer?
Besides getting it over?
I had to qualify that because I knew you'd go there.
I don't know. Just to be able to stand in the same room with the guys that we've talked about before.
Yeah.
To see some of the guys that I played against.
Yeah.
Or with. Mm-hmm. That I haven't seen very often, if at all, since I stopped playing, or since they stopped playing. And to be part of that group. It's a fraternity that is very limited as far as who's even eligible to get in, yeah. Let alone who does get in.
Right.
And there's a lot of people you got to thank for this, and there's a lot of people that you won't thank that really helped along the way.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of guys that said, oh, you did all this, and I go, yeah, well, wait a minute now. There's a lot of guys whose names I don't even remember who caught ground balls, who caught a fly ball, who got a base hit, who scored a run, who got three outs for me in relief that I don't even remember their names. But yet, if it wasn't for what they did at that particular moment, we may not be talking about this. So... like I still, you would go back to that. How'd you do it? I don't know how I did it because it wasn't like I threw seven no hitters,
right,
and struck out 4,000 people.
Yeah.
I didn't do those things. There's plateau numbers that I didn't reach, and yet I did well enough to be in the room with guys that did do it, who did win Cy Young awards, and who did strike out 3,000 people or 300 guys in a year, or led the league 5 or 6 or 10 times. In a category, and it's cool to think that I went from playing wiffle ball in the backyard to Cooperstown, New York, and I get a plaque on the wall at the Hall of Fame.
My thanks to Messina for allowing me the nearly two-hour visit to his hometown and for picking up the lunch tab. While he was not a person I initially thought I would develop any sort of connection with when I first met him in 2001, I did after a while find him to be a very willing teacher of all things pitching and baseball once you cut through the exterior wall and let him figure out that you had intelligent conversation on your mind rather than short, catchy sound bites, although those were certainly appreciated as well in my line of work. And he was good at it too. I look back and think that talks with Mike Messina at his locker are among my favorite things during my time on this job, now almost 20 years. And I hope after listening to both parts of this conversation, you'll understand why. Once again, part one is available on the archive at radio.com, WFAN.com, and on iTunes. You'll find my conversation with Derek Jeter there as well. Go ahead and subscribe, review, all that fun stuff. And next week, my conversation with Mariano Rivera. Until then, thanks for listening.
Spectrum Business keeps real businesses, like Rise Bakery, connected.
As a business owner, my Spectrum services help simplify my day. Everything we do is easier knowing that we've got a reliable connection. And it helps our business just run really smoothly. Even though our techniques are very ancient, we rely just as heavily on technology. Spectrum allows my business to go from surviving to thriving.
Keep your business running smoothly with Spectrum Internet, starting at $40 a month. Restrictions apply. Services not available in all areas.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
I'm Emma Greed, and I'm the host of the Aspire podcast, a show where I talk to the world's most brilliant minds about building the life of your dreams. Listen to and follow Aspire with Emma Greed, an Odyssey podcast, available now wherever you get your podcasts.